Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today I have the great pleasure of welcoming Josiah Hamilton onto my show. Josiah is a lovely man that I've known for a while, and he has come to talk about his life, but especially what his life has been like since he gave up alcohol. And I think that's a really, really important topic, obviously, because in my practice, nobody's ever said alcohol makes their life better. And I hear endless stories of how, you know, it messes up people's lives and relationships.
Dr. Dana Saperstein and the Fear Me Out podcast is pleased to announce that Janus Community Counseling Services is now the proud sponsor of the Fear Me Out podcast. Janus Community Counseling Services is a nonprofit organization in Santa Barbara, California, that is committed to providing professional, affordable counseling. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to the podcast. For more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006.
Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
I want to welcome you, Sir Josiah. I really appreciate it. So give us an idea about who you are, and we'll go from there.
Josiah Hamilton, an avid listener of the Fear Me Out podcast. Thank you. I have been living in Santa Barbara off and on my entire life. I was actually not born here, but moved here 6 months later and lived here in Santa Barbara. And then I kind of started skipping around. I always had a base here with my father, but when my folks separated around 6 years old, 5.5 years old, my mom moved to Boston, and then I commuted, so to speak, back and forth to Boston. And then eventually, a few years after that, she moved to London, and then my mom got full custody. And so I lived in London during the school years and then came to Santa Barbara for all the holidays.
Okay. So
we had long holidays, so it was all summer, Christmas, Thanksgiving, the whole bit.
When your parents were together, do you have much memory for what that was like?
I don't have much memory at all. You know, it's funny, my mom passed away last year, and I obviously have been going through a whole bunch of photos, and other than a wedding and a couple others, I have very few pictures of them together with me and my sister. So, and my memories of them wasn't the best. And it's hard to kind of decipher from photographs and stories told.
Yeah.
But my memory of them was that it wasn't a happy household.
Right.
Dad was working. They had a restaurant, a nice restaurant in Montecito at the time.
Oh, okay.
Back in the 70s. And that took a lot of time for my dad. And I honestly, I was pretty young, so I don't really know what went down. But
did anybody ever explain it to you as you got older about why their marriage didn't work?
I think there's now only one person to tell the story, so that makes it a little bit more challenging. You know, I just think that they had a good thing for a second. They met in a cult in the 70s.
Really?
On the East Coast.
A cult?
It was a cult. The Process. Church of the Final Judgment.
Really?
Yeah. And at the time, if it was today, it probably would have been called like a club. But, you know, back in those days, they were cults and they had a bad rap. But I think all in all, it was a pretty good one. But there, it was a celibate cult. And my mom it started in London and where my mom was. And then she came to Chicago. My dad was in the chapter in Boston, and my mom went from Chicago to Boston, and that's where they connected.
Through a religious sort of cult organization.
Yeah. Yep.
Do you have any idea what the philosophy of the cult was?
Well, a balance between heaven and hell. You know, the one can't live without the other. They did practice celibacy. There was no drugs and alcohol, which was kind of unique in the 60s.
Yeah, I'll say, especially the celibacy part.
Yeah. My dad, ironically, was the only, what was called an IP, internal processee, who had, he was married. He came in married.
Oh. And
so he was the only one. There was those chapters in London, Toronto, Chicago, Boston, and maybe another one somewhere else. And they went around sort of doing their thing, selling magazines and whatever else. You know, I think in that environment, there's nothing outside that. And so it's easy to have a relationship. And then when reality strikes, you leave.
Oh,
my mom and my dad decided to leave. My dad was still married.
Oh, but they fell in love with each other, do you think?
They did. My dad was married. His wife has been shipped off to another sector of the cult. Maybe on purpose. Maybe they were trying to get my folks together. Who knows?
Yeah.
And my dad was smitten with her. You know, she had beautiful long black hair, big eyes. Looks a little bit like my daughter who you've met before. And they wanted to be together. And so they left the process a few years later to be together. And then I think for a little while things worked out, but you know, reality struck. My dad was a kid from New Orleans who played the saxophone, and you know, he was kind of didn't go to college. My mom came from England. She came from a little British aristocracy and had kind of an interesting world back there. In the process, none of that was seen. You're just two people doing the same thing as each other.
Oh, okay.
And then once they got out of that, they kind of traveled around. They got a Winnebago. They drove to Berkeley. They did what you do. Then they went back to England, saw my grandparents. I think my dad began to realize that my mom, you know, had a little dough. But they were still very much in love, and they had me in Boston, and then decided Boston, Wayland in particular, was kind of boring. And so my mom wanted to go see her only aunt, her only actual relative in the United States, was Pearl Chase. And so she
Pearl Chase of Santa Barbara, Pearl
Chase. So that was my mom's, she's my great-great aunt, but she was my mom's great aunt. And so they were very close. And so she went to go see her in Santa Barbara. My dad fell in love with this place. They decided to set up shop, and this is where they stayed, and I was along for the ride.
Well, just for my listeners, Pearl Chase is not a minor figure in Santa Barbara history, that's for sure. So I just want to make sure people know that the connection was of Santa Barbara royalty, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah, so she kind of juggled two worlds of kind of some interesting families.
So that's how they ended up in Santa Barbara.
My dad had never been to Santa Barbara. I mean, maybe on their way to Berkeley in their RV, they passed through it, or maybe they went up the 80. I don't know where they went. But anyways, they bought a house and they started a restaurant that was on Coast Village Road. And I think right around that time is when, you know, drugs and things started to show up. And
In their lives.
And just their relationship, it probably wasn't a very good relationship outside of the process.
Okay.
And I would imagine that was the case for a lot of people. You know, it's probably like a lot of other kind of cultures where they all group together, and then you put them in the real world and
they
can't function well.
Yeah.
So that was kind of that. And then I, you know, had a little sister. She showed up in 77. So this was 75 when they moved out. My sister showed up in 77, and by 80, things had really kind of fallen apart. They were working on a divorce. I think it was final by sort of 81. But that was a pretty pivotal moment for me in my life in terms of, I guess, I don't really have a lot of memory before this, but
okay.
When I was 5, I had an eye accident that left me blind in my right eye just down the street from here.
What happened?
My mom had actually left already. They'd separated. My mom she went to Boston, and my dad was here. He started I'm going to blur these dates a little bit, but
okay.
He'd started a new relationship with someone. They weren't married, and I was with the sitter. I don't remember what her name was, but she lived down the street. I'd spent the night there. The next, it was a birthday party. The girl, she had a party, and there was a pinata for the party. And then we went out the next day. My sister, I think it was my sister and I, but I think it might have just been myself and the girl Jessica. And there was those sticks that were there from yesterday, and we swung at the string, playing like kids do. And her stick, which was a table leg, had a nail on the end of it, and that went straight through my eyeball.
Oh my God!
So yes. I am that kid. Don't play with sticks.
Yeah, no kidding.
I'm the kid. I'm the story.
Well, sticks with nails.
Yeah, I don't know what the nail was doing there. Maybe it wasn't part of the program, but anyways, it was part of my program.
So how in the world did you cope with having a nail go into your eye?
Who knows how this all went down, but the mom, you know, I do remember my hands being over my face, sort of holding everything together. You know, my imagination is that it was probably like a switchblade where it was just like, you know, in and out. And that was that. She had a Mustang. I remember that. And we drove to, I can't remember. It might've been like whatever would have been the market then, the Albertsons up on the Mesa here. And I remember being in the back of the car and she was going in to get me probably an ice pack or some bandages or something like that.
Not to the hospital?
Not to the hospital. Actually, not even did I, I ended up, she told me to stop crying. At least I remember, these are some very vague memories. And then we went to the doctor's office. I don't know where that was. And the doctor was like, get this kid. Anyways, ambulance showed up. Boom, I'm out there. But my parents aren't anywhere to be found. My mom's in Boston. My dad's maybe on it somewhere. Wow. And so my dad does arrive. And, you know, the rest is really, no pun, but very blurry. And then shortly thereafter, they were separated.
And they couldn't save your eye, obviously.
No, that was corneal. And my mom had some money, so there was, over the next 5 years, there was a lot of surgeries that were performed, corneal transplants and, you know, this and that. But yeah, I was masked up for the duration.
Oh, how do you think that affected you sort of emotionally?
I feel like I was able to, you know, for all the wrongs that everything was, that was happening in my life, my mom and my dad were super encouraging, and they were always, when my mom could be there, she was there. When my dad obviously was there all the time, and my stepmom, eventually my stepmom, she was there, and there was a lot of love around that. And it was obviously a horrible situation that no one wishes on anyone.
Yeah,
you know, as time went on, I was at Montecito Union, and you know, there was one camp that was super helpful and super supportive, and then there was another camp that was calling me Cyclops, and you know, one eye this and one eye that. And, you know, kids are rough. You know, sort of part of me thinks that there was a lot of things good that ended up coming of that, and personality traits that I'm fond of that I have today. It allowed me to find, you know, other ways of communication, ways to combat, you know, ridicule. It also did a great thing, which is take my mind, I think, probably off what my parents were dealing with.
Oh, okay.
So I had my new I had my own distraction. I'm just making stuff up right now. I don't know how it all went, but there was a lot of fucked up shit that was going on up until that point. You know?
Okay. Yeah. When you say, are you talking about between your parents or?
Yeah. I mean, I was just exposed. I got exposed to some, there was a lot of coke. I mean, my mom told me a story, you know, where I ended up finding a bag of coke in her bag, and I poured it all out all over the place. And
wow,
I had some anger issues. I cut out all these chair seats that were these like fucking medieval Roman looking chairs that probably cost a fortune. And I cut it. They're all leather. And I got a knife out of the kitchen and cut all the seats out, so they were kind of unusable.
Wow.
There was parties that I ended up going to. There was parties at the house. There was lots of stuff going on.
That's a little kid.
Yeah. I mean, showing up with my PJs with the feet in and seeing coke and seeing girls. I mean, it was a lot of stuff. It was the 70s and it was volume 11.
Wow. And this in Boston or here?
No, this is here. Okay. This is here in Santa Barbara.
Before your mom left?
Yeah, before my mom left. Yeah.
Okay.
I can't really tell you those dates or when that was, but I would give it a shot that it's somewhere between 77... 6 and the 80, so.
Okay, and were both your parents using drugs? And
Yeah, they were. And you know, I can't say that there was anything, like, there was no physical abuse or that I was witness to, or there was, this sounds crazy thinking back, because I would never be like this with my kids, but there was never, I don't get the impression that there was anything unsafe, but there was just a lot of, of course it was unsafe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. It sounds like it was pretty out of control.
Swimming pools and fast cars and a bunch of people with blow.
Wow.
And, you know, there was little games that were played that were, you know, I would go up to girls and I'd give them money, and I was 5 years old, whatever it was, 4 years old. And they'd show me their top. They'd show me their boobs. And you
as
know,
a 5 or 6 year old,
something like that. Yeah. Wow. There was, I'm not even going to tell you the name of the game, but anyways, it was not appropriate for a 5 year old.
And who encouraged you to do this sort of thing?
I sort of think there just wasn't a lot of supervision. And so there was just a lot of people around, and I was known as this kid who was part of the family, so to speak, the partying family. I was just around, and I was probably a little nosy, a little mischievous, probably asked some questions and wanted to be in the mix.
Was your dad owning the restaurant at that time also? Was that part of the culture?
That was absolutely part of the culture. I don't know if that culture really changed too much, you know.
Over the course of the years, you
mean? Yeah, now it's just, you know, they DoorDash it to you.
but you don't necessarily remember feeling anxiety or unsafe in the situation.
The only time I feel like there was sort of sadness or anxiety, I mean, I obviously, when my mom left, I mean, I don't know, my eye really occupied a lot of my life.
I bet.
You know, that's what was, it was really hard to go to school pictures, you know, I already had a bowl cut, so it was bad enough, but throw a patch on it. And you're also like, you know, 3'2", you know, I was short, bowl cut, you know.
Oh, okay.
Cards were stacked against me as it was.
Yeah.
And getting teased was no fun. You know, I didn't think I was that smart. Like school was not something I was real keen on.
Okay.
Probably because of that, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, it's painful. And if you're at all different than any other kid, they're going to torture you.
Yeah, it was rough. So I lent in on humor, you know, class clown. That started pretty quick. If I could make him laugh, maybe I could distract him from that. So that's kind of where my head decided to go. It's like, oh shit, I can get some attention doing this. Maybe I can take some attention off of that.
Did anybody know that you were struggling, or were they way too preoccupied to pay attention?
I don't know. As a father of a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old, I don't know if those kids are paying attention to that kind of stuff. I might have had a babysitter, at the time. There was a lot of shit going on. I mean, divorce and then new kind of stepmom showing. I mean, I'm talking, this is like a 2 or 3 year window. So it was a lot of moving parts that were happening. And then, I started the custody thing took a while. And my dad actually had custody because I don't think my mom really knew where she was going to land. She ended up going to Boston, ironically, moving in and eventually marrying another member of the process.
She went back to the cult?
She didn't go back to the cult. There was a lot of people had already left, but she ended up marrying another man who ended up being my stepdad, who was also in the cult, who was in the process. And then, you know, he had 2 kids, and one of the kids, my stepbrother, ex-stepbrother, now his mom was also in the cult. It was hard to get away from it. There was attorneys that were in it. There was, you know, it had long fingers.
So how'd you go from dad having custody to mom?
So my mom decided, I think, that she wanted to have us, right? She wanted to have my sister and I, and she fought hard, and she had money, and she, I don't know what anybody would do in this situation. I don't think my dad had the horsepower to fight the fight. And at some point, someone's got to kind of give in. And my mom won. She got custody. My sister and I up and leave to Boston.
How old?
I was, let's say that was 1980. That was probably 83.
Okay.
Yeah, 83.
And how old are you?
So I'm sorry. So I was like 7 or 8.
Okay. So still pretty young.
Yeah, pretty young.
Was it painful to leave your dad?
I think it was painful. The one silver lining for me is that there was an older brother that I still love him to pieces. We're really close. And so obviously I think it was terrifying, this idea of going there. And I do remember the day where I was like shaking people's hands. I'm like, here's your new family.
Wow.
And, you know, I do remember sort of awkward shit like that. But my brother was a great dude then, and he's a great dude now.
So you guys bonded with each other?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he came from already a divorce situation too. And then his half-sister, who was also in the mix, was my stepdad. He was married a few times. yeah, it was all, and then fast forward, we stayed in Boston for 2 years with my mom. And then my mom decided, this was just, remember, like I have friends that are divorced in Santa Barbara, and uh-huh. one family lives in San Roque, okay. and the other parent lives on the Mesa.
Right.
And they have weeks on, weeks off.
Uh-huh.
We were a 10-hour time difference or 10-hour flight to London. My sister and I were flying 4 to 5 times a year, unaccompanied. And, you know, it sounds all great. Oh, my God, that's so cool. You got to live
in London.
That
doesn't sound great.
I never felt like I lived anywhere.
Yeah, I
felt
I was
like
going to say.
You know, you cross that line wherever the center divider is, and you just, I wasn't sad anymore that I was leaving my dad. I switched into mom mode. And I'm going to this family now, and this is how I'm going to be. And so you really adapted to this sort of, you just became an, I don't want to go as far as saying an actor, but you definitely were a chameleon and a fucking good one.
I would imagine. And so you're sort of made fun of in the country that you're from. What happened when you went to London in terms of not speaking the language, if you know what I mean? And
well, that was, so back up one bit. When we lived in Boston, my mom was hell-bent on getting my eye fixed. So I was going to multiple surgeries and all this stuff. And we realized after, I think, whatever, 3 corneal transplants. I mean, I was in surgery for 5 years,
wow.
in and out school, trying to get this thing to be right. It actually did take, and then I took a football to the eye, and it disconnected.
Oh my God.
So I don't remember that. It's just the story. But either way, I was not meant to see out of this eye.
Okay.
But my mom found a guy who did these glass eye. There's it was a prosthesis. And so he did this hand painted eye. And anyways, I was, for the first time, I was back to normal. So when I went to London, I didn't look like I was blind in one eye.
Oh, okay.
So it was a new me. I was excited. Yeah. It was probably exciting because I got to start fresh. I've actually never thought of it like that.
Yeah.
I got to start fresh coming into a new school. And then the bomb dropped. We go to do the testing at the school that I was going to go to where all of us were going to go to. My sister, Emma, who's my blood sister, and then my stepbrother and stepsister. And they gave me a test and they're like, he's dyslexic. We don't have a place for him here. And my mom was like, okay, well, what do we do? And so she found another school. So, short bus, I'm going to what it ended up being a fine school, but in my mind, I'm not going where all the other kids get to go. So as soon as I started feeling good, this is funny. I've never thought about it like this. But as soon as all the other kids in my house got to go to this great big school where it's all fun and I'm taking the short bus. And actually, it was a short bus for the first little while. And I told my mom, there's no way I'm going on this thing. So I just took the subway.
Wow.
So that was that. So we get to London and it's a new life. It's a new world. And
were you lonely at school? Going to a different school than your...
That school was interesting. There was a lot of kids that came from some fucked up families. And I don't want to say that my family was fucked up, but it certainly didn't follow any tradition. And I just remember meeting a couple kids and I'd started skateboarding.
Okay.
Quite a while ago, as you do if you live in Santa Barbara as a kid. And I kind of was this kid from California that skated, and that was kind of cool to a couple people there. Anyways, we all sort of started skating. And again, school was not really a thing that worked out well for me.
Yeah.
My stepdad he made fun of me all the time. And, it was like, I'd write things backwards or I couldn't read. Reading was such a fucking terrible thing for me. And to read a book, like the idea of having to sit in front of that for that long was
impossible. Yeah.
Words were backwards. I just couldn't get through stuff. I'd read 3 lines and I'd be off thinking about, squirrel.
Yeah. So did you get in trouble?
Not right away. Not right away. I mean, I started doing stuff that was pretty fucking stupid. We'd go, it was a cool school. We went on these adventure trips and
with the school.
Yeah. With the school. I would guess it was sort of like a Santa Barbara middle school, if you will, right?
Okay.
And you know, we you could take these ferries to France and went to France, and in France you could buy fireworks and you could buy smoke bombs and stink bombs and whatever you could buy. I bought.
Perfect for a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Switchblades, you know, all this stuff, nunchucks, throwing. I mean, I don't know. It was like, why are you taking children here? Anyways, I mean, the first thing was, you know, we got a box of smoke bombs and we threw them down the ventilation system on this French ferry and the whole place smelled like a turd. And we got chased out. I got suspended. Anyway, my stepdad was fucking ruthless. The one thing my stepdad did though, is he did set some rules. I mean, he was like, he had, there was structure there. Whether he was, you know, he was a dick to my mom. That was contentious. He was shouted a lot at my sister. My sister had a tough go with him. My mom was, you know, didn't really know what to do. You know, and I was fortunate enough to have my brother, and I could kind of sit behind his armor a little bit,
right?
Let him take the heat sometimes, but it sucked. It sucked. I mean, it was, and this isn't even my house. Like, yeah. I don't know where I live, you know?
Right.
And then they separated. There was a time, God, he was a fucking ass. My brother left for college. My stepsister, I don't know where she went, but she left. And then there was a moment where we were in the house, just my mom and I and my sister. And, you know, they fought and fought and fought. He was cheating all over the place. And there was a night, this was kind of the last night I remember, but my bedroom was on the top floor. In London, the houses are skinny, but they're tall. And so I lived up on the top floor. My sister lived down the next one down, and my mom. But I was all the way at the top. And I hear my mom just screaming. And I come down, and my stepdad is holding this electric heater, which those old school heaters, like, they weren't safe, right? Yeah. And so he's threatening to throw it onto the curtains and burn the whole place down.
Oh my God.
And I come down, so I'm probably 14, 15, and I was like, this, get the fuck out. What are you doing? You know, like, and it was just a shit show. Anyways, shortly after that, they split.
Oh, okay.
And then my mom ended up selling the house, and my sister and I and my mom. And that was really the turning. That's when things really started to come loose. And, you know, that's when I started getting into some pretty good drugs. And
What kind of drugs were you drawn to?
Kind of anything that took my mind away from things. So I was kind of, I didn't really love weed at first, but it kind of grew on me. And then we just started, you know, messing around with acid and, you know, that was our first thing. It was acid and take a bunch of it and go sit in the park and skip school. And I didn't have Robert. So, you know, he wasn't there to track me.
Right. Right.
And it was kind of, you know, we're still skating a bunch and having a good uh-huh. time. And I'd leave on a Friday. I'd come back on a, you know, Sunday. And I think my mom was excited to not have that guy in her life. And so she was gone doing her thing. And so it was just kind of a little bit of a free for all.
Complete neglect.
I mean, my sister and I were cleaning out my mom's house. We've been doing this for a while. And, you know, my sister's found all these notes and I found some notes. And one of the notes we found was on a post-it note, be back on Tuesday.
Oh, okay.
Love, Mom. Could have been written on Thursday. Could have been written on the Tuesday before.
Yeah.
It was a lot of that. Right. I don't know where she went, but that was kind of the deal.
Wow.
We were a little, maybe Emma less than me, but definitely we were a little feral.
I would imagine. It sounds like you're completely, you know, had to take care of yourself.
Yeah.
And how'd you get food and all of that stuff?
Well, there was always food or we just go over to someone else's house and kind of went. I mean, I don't know that it's a whole lot different now. Maybe it's just a list of the narcotics or who knows what it is. But you know, and that was a slippery slope and
did you get involved in like heavier drugs?
I did. Yeah. I mean, it kind of went in waves. I kind of stuck to the party drugs. I mean, this was like, you know, London in those years was incredible. I mean, it was, you know, it was an amazing place with art and music and culture and the city wasn't safe. It was pretty rough. And where we lived, it was kind of rough too. We were in West London. I had friends that were in the Brixton area and, you know, you got mugged a lot. Like a lot, knives pulled on you, and you know, you got a sense of like, you know, you had to take care of yourself.
Right.
We really liked the party drugs. It was like birth, you know, acid house parties were starting, the big rave scene was happening, and you know, we went down that drain real hard. And
when you say we, you and your friends.
Me and my friends, yeah. And these were actually a lot of friends that I went to school with. Yeah. And we were these misfits kind of kids. And we found our tribe. Like, we were really tight. And nobody, our parents weren't around. If they were, they were doing their own shit. We were stealing vodka or gin from Lloyd's mom. And we were smoking weed and breaking shit at Ed's house and doing graffiti. And, you know, it was just... I mean, I've got some friends I talk to still, and we just like, where the fuck was everybody?
Yeah.
It was like lights on, no one's home.
Right.
And, you know, we just, you know, we started selling. My mom then kind of came back and, you know, she said to me, you know, you can't live here anymore unless you're going to stop selling.
Oh.
You know, and we were selling ecstasy and acid and all this other stuff. Right. And I said, I'm not done. You know, I'm not done doing whatever the hell it is I'm doing. And so she said, all right, there's the door.
And you were how old?
I just graduated high school.
Oh, okay.
I graduated a little early, so not because I was smart. I barely graduated. Actually, I got kicked out for stealing money from the school.
Oh.
To go buy some drugs and, anyway.
So if your mom is connected to... like the higher society, was that part of your life in any way?
Yeah. I mean, the way that sort of hierarchy works is, you know, it goes to the firstborn male.
Oh, okay.
My mom was the last child and a woman. So she was definitely not of significance in her family. She had a pretty rough upbringing, in terms of just, you know, total neglect, and then two big suicides. Her mother and her sister committed suicide.
Both of them?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Sister first and then mother later on. So that was, you know.
So she didn't stand much of a chance either.
No, I mean, she really did the best she could, I think. And, you know, without very little, it's amazing she didn't go off the deep end a million times. She actually, I think, did a lot of amazing things when she was alive. Parenting wasn't one of them. She, you know.
So you would come to see your dad for holidays and stuff.
Yeah.
What did you do about the lifestyle you were living in London when you came to California?
It wasn't too difficult to sniff out in California.
So you just did the same thing
here. Our friends were doing all sorts of crazy shit here too. We just did it differently.
Oh, okay.
You know, but I never really felt like I belonged here or I belonged there.
Oh,
I
mean, okay.
I think some people thought it was cool that I was from London. Other people thought it was cool that I was from California, but I didn't really feel like I was from anywhere. You know, I just didn't have a sense of being, I felt that's why the drugs kind of made me feel like I was part of something.
So how in the world did you become like a semi-functioning adult through all of this?
Well, I mean, you know, I think
that's a lot of shit to deal with right from the get-go.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you're born with I don't know. There's been a lot of kind people on the way I've seen things that I've been like, that looks, but you know, honestly, like I really enjoyed getting fucked up.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. It was a really safe place for me.
Yeah.
And it didn't, you know, and it also gave me something to feel proud of. And I know this sounds crazy, but, you know, we weren't just taking a hit of E and going to a rave. Like, we were eating a box of them.
Wow.
And, you know, and it was like you were that guy and your friends were those guys and those girls were those partiers. And right. we rode hard and that was our thing. And that was an identity that we felt so comfortable with.
Oh, okay.
And then there was a few little checks along the way. I had a couple friends who started getting into heroin, which, you know, we dabbled in a little bit. And then I was like, this isn't for me. This is kind of gnarly. And then a roommate I had, you know, one day we were on a bender and I went downstairs and there was a stolen car in a garage that I didn't even know we had.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I got to get out of here. And so I had a little, you know, I wasn't totally out of my mind.
Moments of clarity.
Yeah. I mean, I did this stuff because it was fun. I didn't do this stuff for other reasons.
Right. Right.
You know, and then I think slowly you just sort of see things in life that you want. I knew I wanted a family at some point. I knew I wanted, You know, I knew I wanted a house maybe if I was fortunate enough to do that. I knew I wanted a nicer car. Okay. You know, so things like that. There was like these little material goals. And, you know, but the partying didn't really stop.
And eventually you did leave London and move to California?
I did, yeah. So I, after the car scene, when I found a stolen car, I told my roommate, I'm like, I'm out of here. I'm moving out. And I couldn't move back to my mom's house.
Right.
Through a couple girlfriends and living on sofas for a little while, just trying to figure out what the fuck I was doing. I called my stepdad. Oh. And I said, is there any way, he lived out in the countryside. And I said, is there any way that I can come work for you for a couple weeks or something? Just, I need to get my shit together. Things are real weird.
Yeah.
And I was out there, and then my dad knew I was out there. I think that probably was unsettling for him. And he called me one day and he's like, hey, listen, I heard about a job in Santa Barbara for the summer. If you want to come out for
a
delivery guy delivering wine for the wine cask.
And this was when you were like 20 or something?
Yeah. And I would have gone to frickin' Beirut. I mean, I would have gone anywhere other than where I was just to get away from that. And so I was like, great. And he's like, you can live with us. Uh-huh. I was like, I'll only live with you for a month. I don't want to, you know, be a burden. And he's like, just come in here and we'll set it up and sort it out. And 3 weeks later I get a DUI. I mean, I couldn't help myself. It was just like, you know,
yeah.
I knew what I knew, and that was getting, I quickly found my tribe again, and we were out at the bars and fake IDs and
wow,
you know, drinking and driving. And, you know, then I had to, so that DUI forced me to move into Santa Barbara because my dad was out in Summerlin. And it, you know, it was the bar scene. And then I was working, it was the restaurant scene. I felt like I was reliving my dad's life. You know, we were doing a ton of blow and we were drinking all night and drinking all day. And
wow.
And that story just went on until it's sort of like the coke stopped eventually. And then the drink just continued. You know, obviously it continued less. And it did start to get less, but it still was always there.
Okay. And when in all of this did you meet your wife?
I met Justine. Great day. I met her in 90. I met her in 96. So not long after I got here.
Oh, okay.
And that was a great story. She was on her bachelorette party, and I just happened to be at the bars, and I knew the girl throwing it, and I was always at the bars. And we met that way, and she got married, and it was obviously wouldn't have worked because I was out of my mind. And then we somehow linked up again 6 years later in Santa Barbara. Yeah, she was no longer married.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And you guys have been together obviously ever since.
Yeah, we're going on our 20th year.
It's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing. She's a great woman.
Two really beautiful children.
Thank you.
I have the great pleasure of knowing everybody in your family.
Yeah.
And the Justine that we're talking about has been a co-host on this podcast a few times.
Yeah.
Which is really lovely. So you're now quite a responsible kind of guy. I mean nobody would ever know that you had this kind of
I think the thing about alcohol is that it's so, I mean, let's get the coke and everything else out of the way because that went away. But alcohol is so accepted. It's such a part of our culture that it's just, you know, and then you're in the wine business, right? So you're part of this whole culture. And, you know, I just didn't know any different. Like everything I did was, oh, we're going to Mexico, or we're going to go to a Mexican restaurant. Let's have some tequila, or we're going to go to restaurant, have a nice steak. We'll get some. Everything was a trigger.
Yeah.
Everything was a trigger. We're going to go get a hamburger at the Nugget. So that's going to be this drink. You're going to, you know, it's someone's birthday. Oh, so they like this. So we'll bring them some this. And you never even think about it. It's just so automatic.
Just part of life.
It's just part of life. And then I think over years of, my mom was a psychotherapist. And so she was a psychotherapist. She treated people that couldn't afford it. So in London, there was this, where we lived in West London, there was a Westway, like an overpass. And there was a caravan, kind of like a little camper van that she worked out of.
Oh, okay.
And homeless people would come in there, usually homeless people, and she would talk to them about whatever their problems were.
Okay.
Often those homeless people would end up coming to our house, and I'd see them leaving with sweatshirts that were mine or a toothbrush of mine, or they'd be at dinner. whatever. But either way, that language of therapy wasn't foreign to me.
Yeah.
And so I always liked kind of diving into these things and understanding uh-huh. about myself and understanding about the world and how things work and relationships. And so it's funny, I think about these things, nothing ever really, there's all this therapy, but there's never like this, there's never therapy. It's always like talking about you, but it never discusses substances that you're, cause it's so acceptable, right? Like, uh-huh. so like, sure, you can go to therapy and you can also go drink a bottle of wine every night. Uh-huh. Right. But
sure.
But maybe we should figure out why we're drinking that bottle of wine every night or uh-huh. a bottle of tequila or whatever the hell it is. And I wasn't drinking a bottle of wine every night. There was definitely times where I didn't drink for, uh-huh. you know, I was very public in the house about it. Like I'd have a thing on the counter on the fridge and dad's not drinking. And I'd check boxes like I was in prison.
Okay.
And sometimes it felt like I was in prison. Sometimes it felt great. Sometimes I'd go 2 weeks. Sometimes I'd go a month. Sometimes whatever.
You mean without alcohol?
Without alcohol.
Yeah. But always found your way back.
I didn't see a connection with it. Like with any, backing up, you know me, I've been coming mm-hmm. to you for a long time. We went to other therapists. There was, you know, you have two kids pretty quickly. 2008, like Justine and I were living in Palm Springs. The kids were born. We'd made some good money. We were in a pretty good place. But we had a fucking 1-year-old and a 2-year-old. And then 2008 came and we basically lost everything. And you know, a lot of depression came in, paying big credit card debt paying big house debt with credit cards. And we were leveraged yeah. to a very uncomfortable situation. And we managed to get ourselves out of it, move back to Santa Barbara. But again, the kind of the partying never stopped. I don't want to go too much into all that stuff, but.
How'd you get to a place where you decided that alcohol was not for you anymore?
Well, I think anybody who gets after it has had more than a few mornings where they've woken up feeling like that doesn't really feel right anymore. I don't like how you know there's some clarity that comes that next day where it's like this isn't what I want to be. Uh-huh. I got to go for a run. I got to do these things, and I don't like how my relationship's going. But I was always blaming these other things. The kids are crazy. I'm going to have a drink to calm down. Or Justine and my relationship is challenging right now. You know, I'm got these problems. I, you know, my mom's always told the story that, you know, you've got depression in your family.
Right.
So, you know, if I was ever sad or under the weather, I would just assume that was because I'm genetically predisposed to right. depression.
Uh-huh.
I never had any suicidal tendencies. I mean, maybe I thought about it, but it wasn't like I was going to think about it any further than thinking about it.
Right.
And I, you know, I would journal. Like one of the things I've noticed is I started journaling. Justine's been journaling since she was like, could hold a pen. And I always admired that because she can read it, you know, she can remember something from, you know, I won't tell you how old she is, but a long time ago, she could recite something. And I started journaling and I kept journaling and kept journaling and kept journaling. And I would write about all these things, these negative things that were happening in my life, you know, that I thought were, you know, I wasn't being creative. I wasn't being who I thought I wanted to be. My relationship was, and I would blame her for things. I felt like I was never really looking at myself, but I was trying to,
uh-huh.
I just kind of wanted to blame everybody else.
Sure.
My depression is your fault. Right. Or my sadness is your fault or someone else's fault, or it's, you know, maybe my fault because I haven't been able to find that creative outlet that I, you know, I was tired of my job. Like, what the fuck am I doing?
Right.
I kind of feel like I'm talking about stuff that I wasn't really planning on talking about before I came in here. I was sort of hoping to, anyways, how's it going so far? You feel good?
Fantastic.
About
okay. Yeah. I think you should keep going because we're getting to the decision that you made to stop altering your consciousness and being connected to yourself on a deeper level.
Yeah. So again, I'd sort of talked about going back and forth with these spells of not drinking. And I told myself, I had this hard time with addict, mm-hmm. sobriety, alcoholism.
Right.
Those labels were really tricky for me to uh-huh. identify with. Sure. I didn't identify with anything already. Uh-huh. I'm certainly not going to identify with a bunch of other people about right. this one word.
Uh-huh.
Like, that just seemed too foreign to me.
Okay.
And I'm a lone wolf. Why would I want to be in a club with those people? Right. Nothing against them. I love right. that that's there for them, but I just uh-huh. couldn't do it. I didn't.
Sure.
I started writing again. I've read back, you know, from 2019 to 2020 and like, you know, just going back and angry with drinking, yes. angry with how it makes me feel, angry with, you know, this is not what I want to do. This is not what I want to be. I want to feel better in the morning. I want to feel, you know, and you do all this other bullshit. I'm going to fucking meditate. I'm going to eat greens and I'm going to do smoothies and what the fuck else ritualistic retreat person's going to tell you to do. Read this book, download that podcast, whatever, right? I kept writing and kept writing and kept writing. And again, I think this really goes to, you know, you hear it all the time. You cannot stop whatever the fuck bad habit you're doing until it's right for you.
Right.
And that could be today. That could be 10 years from now.
Yeah.
It's going to happen, or maybe it won't. I don't know. I hope it does for people.
Yeah.
And there was a time we were traveling and we'd had a killer trip and it was the last night and I was like, God, we're just sitting at this great place. I'm just going to sit down and drink some wine. The kids were with us and Justine, she thought we got a flight in the morning. She was tired. I was like, I'm having fun. Drink some more wine. This is July 2022.
Okay.
And woke up the next day, got to the airport, probably drank more than I should have. I felt fine though, fine enough. And get in the plane. It would have been super normal for me to order a drink on the plane.
Yeah.
10 hours flight. I'll have a Bloody Mary. I was like, you know what? I'm just not going to drink today. And that was that. Like, I mean, it wasn't that, but I was like, I set that date. I didn't even think about it. I'm not going to drink on the plane. And then that turned into the next day. And then that turned into the next day. And I would journal a little bit more and I'd kind of talk about the journey. And I promised myself one thing. I was like, I know these people who are trying not to drink and they just stay away from all the things that are familiar to them.
Right.
Change their friend group, change their tribe, change all this stuff. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go to dinner and I'm going to go to the places I like to go. And I'm just going to try my hardest. I'm going to drink some fucking grapefruit juice with soda water. I'll try something else. And, you know, I have an old car and it kind of means a lot to me. And I'll drive that car. Cause if I can't get a DUI in that car, it'll help me not to drink.
Okay.
So I had like these little tricks that I'd play with myself. Uh-huh. And then, you know, time went on a little bit more. I obviously shared a lot of stuff with you. And you were super helpful with this, you know, and then, you know, just even say things like, well, I'm going to have a drink. Is that all right with you? And I'm like, yeah, it's fine. Like that's what I don't want anything to change except for me.
Right.
And it just kind of went on like this for a little while and it slowly became a game. And I just wanted to continue playing the game. And then, mm-hmm. you know, the kids are getting older and I was like, well, yeah. And then my mom, she got diagnosed with cancer. And so like all of a sudden I was like, fuck, I got to be alert for this. Like, There was these moments, kids are driving. I'm like, I don't want to get the call, you know, that my dad got when I got a DUI. Mm-hmm. I don't want that call that I can't drive to.
Right.
I don't want to get that call from my mom that something's going down that I need to fly to London for. And I want to be present when she calls me and when I talk to her. These are big items in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And they really helped. Sadly, my mom passed away, but you know, her cancer really helped keep me in line, you know, so I could be there for her
right.
in a time, which was hard, obviously for her. We're separated uh-huh. by a 10 hour flight. And you know, her mornings were my nights and vice versa. So you live in two different worlds.
Yeah. So how do you think that not having alcohol in your life has affected you when you look back now in the last year or so, a year and a half?
Well, I think it created an identity. I've learned a lot from it now, but it created an identity in myself that was so real to me. That was me.
For the first time in your life, huh?
Pardon me?
First time in your life?
No, I'm talking about what drugs and alcohol did to me. They gave me a sense of purpose.
Oh, okay.
It gave me a sense of being. It gave me a sense of feeling and tribe and being a part of something. And it gave me life, to be honest with you. It gave me family.
Sure.
It didn't neglect me and it didn't discriminate. Right. It did all those things that I didn't feel like I had. And so it was really difficult for me to, you got to look in the mirror and you got to see what these things are. And you got to, I'm feeling a little sad, or I'm feeling depressed. You know, when the debris flow happened in Montecito, that was a crazy time, obviously, for a lot of people. But we were instrumental in starting the Bucket Brigade. And you really just saw how precious life is so quickly. And, families, people we've known for our whole lives and families who lost other families and people whose their whole world was in a river down into the ocean. And you realize these things, what is it all? What does all this mean? What is the purpose of living?
Yeah.
If all of it can go down the fucking river into the ocean and you're left with nothing,
right?
Maybe even lose somebody you love.
Yeah.
What is the fucking meaning of life? And I went into a dark hole. I got super depressed, just because one, and I think the way I combated my depression during that period was to go, don't listen to your depression. You're going to go solve other people's problems. You're going to go dig until you can't fucking move your hands anymore. And you're going to dig these people out and dig their houses out. And you're going to do what you do with drinking. You're going to ignore yourself again. And you're going to ignore yourself because you don't matter. Right. And you've never really mattered.
Yeah.
And that was a fucking gnarly time. And we drank right through it too. We drank all the time. I mean, all of us were a fucking mess, five of us.
I can imagine.
Tequila
must have been really tough.
Yeah, it was fucking gnarly. It was so colossal.
Yeah.
And I was on the outside of it. I lived near it, but I wasn't affected the way some people were affected.
Right.
I mean, not even remotely close. But that triggered something in me that was I really got attached to depression. And I really realized I'm going to believe this story that's been told to me for so long. You're depressed. Your family has depression.
Right.
And I don't know how to get out of it. Two people solved it by shooting themselves. That sounds like a fucking terrible idea. I'm not interested in that, but fuck, this is bad. Yeah. And I can probably drink through it 'cause I'm pretty good at that. And then that ended, and then you sort of feel like, wow, I have really no purpose. These people are getting their lives back together, and then I'm going to go home, and I've now neglected my family. I've neglected my job. I didn't work for 5 months.
Wow.
I was, I'd wake up every day, 7 days a week, and I'd get my shovel and my boots, and I'd go out there, and we'd do that. And then you come back and you're like, that was my cult, right?
Right.
We had a bond with all those people. And I just neglected myself again. And then I neglected my family. And Justine and I were, shit, man, you were right there. So you saw some of the stuff. And again, going back, so fast forward, whatever. I don't even know what all that dates are, all a mess. But I kept journaling. Journaling, I swear to God, is the most amazing. If there's one thing I can advise anybody, I don't care what the fuck you're going through, good or bad, write everything that you can. I mean, this morning the first thing I wrote was this is really hard to start writing. Yeah. And I just started writing. Yeah. That was all it took. Just write some bullshit, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I've written that before, blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden it turns into something.
Uh-huh.
Next thing you know, and I find it, if you handwrite, there's a difference between handwriting and typing.
Right.
And I'm dyslexic. I still write like a fucking crazy man. Shit's backwards. I cross it out. There's no judgment. No one's reading it. I may not even read it. If I do, I may not be able to read it, but it doesn't matter. Anyways, going back to this not drinking, I decided to not drink. And then I had a friend in Montecito. He's a chef. He's a great dude. He's not really a friend. He wasn't at the time. I mean, he's somebody I liked, and I knew that he was an alcoholic. He went to AA, did all that stuff. So I like asked him some questions. Mm-hmm. I was like, hey man, listen, I'm kind of in this place right now where I'm trying to stop this. And you know, do you have any advice or whatever? And he's just like, I don't know. He just became this person for me that I could lean on a little bit. And I would thank him for sitting with me for 10 minutes. I didn't know him. I don't really know much about his family. I didn't really know much about his past. He didn't know fuck all about mine, other than we were kind of connected and, you know, through some mutual friends. And anyways, he was kind of this guiding light. And I still to this day kind of thank him for these things. And, you know, then all of a sudden, like, other people started popping up. Like, I'd read some Instagram post this girl posted, and she's like, 7 years. So I just sent her a message. I was like, 7 years what? She's like, 7 years sober. This is somebody back in the day we used to get after it pretty good with.
Yeah.
And, you know, she and I were exchanging. I mean, I haven't seen the girl in 8 years.
Right.
And so she was kind of helping me out and go through this stuff. I kept journaling and kept journaling. And I don't know when it was. I said to Justine, I was like, God, you know, I don't know if this is real or not, but like, I don't think I have depression. Like, I don't think I'm depressed. And I don't know, but I just feel like not drinking has like, I go the, I think the, you know, I've been writing in this journal about all these things that I don't like about drinking, and literally in the same paragraph, I'm writing about all these problems that I'm having in my life, right? Justine and I aren't doing this, or this isn't happening, or she said this, and I'm like, fuck, whatever, that's stupid, don't call me that name. And then we fight, and then I go radio silent, and I give her the silent treatment for 3 days, 4 days, whatever I needed to do. I'm not having good communication with my son, who's probably a little bit like I am, and, you know, I'm having a tough time with my mom. It's just, and then I realize, I'm like, wait a second, like, all of these things are, do you remember those weird things? They're like in the 80s, the miracle thaw board. It was like this, I still don't know what it was, but you could stick a steak on it and the thing would melt super slowly. Anyways, used to get super high and watch that sidebar. This was like I felt like everything was just melting, like slowly, slowly melting. With every day, every week that passed, not drinking, I slowly saw that Justine would say something. I wasn't reactive. Something would happen with the kid. I didn't take it personally. When I say reactive, it was more like I was looking at it as a dig on me. You're stupid, or you're not smart, or, you know, why didn't this happen? Like, I took that as, you're an idiot. You're 10 years old. You've got dyslexia. You fucking retard. That's how I perceived all of it. And all those things, she'd say something and it was just like a little, you know, ping off a can, you know. And then, I mean, today is, we're like a year and a half sober. Sober sounds weird. I'm a year and a half not drinking. And I put myself in all sorts of positions. Been in nightclubs. I've been in bars, stayed up late. I do have a cutoff now. It's probably like 10. I don't want to see people after that. They start to bug the shit out of me. And I just never realized, you know, obviously I'm doing the work with you. I've gone to, did Hoffman, which was incredible.
Yeah.
I think I've done a lot of upfront work on realizing that I do have some things I need to deal with on a cellular level and confronting those things. But all through that, I kept drinking. And still thinking I had depression and still thinking I had anxiety was something I didn't actually know I had.
Right.
Until probably, and I'm not, you know, people talk about dry January, like you're going to feel different. Okay. Maybe you feel a little bit different, but this shit took me like a solid 6 months, maybe 7 months, 8 months. And there's even things that are happening. Like something happened the other day that I shared with you, which was just like, there's some clarity around things I'm seeing now, you know, opportunities, emotional opportunities, not only opportunities in business or opportunities but emotional opportunities to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And the ability to want to be vulnerable and to share that with people.
So it's really been a miracle to give up alcohol for you.
I think it's the fucking devil's juice. And I think I don't think anybody wants to be taken advantage of. Nobody wants to be taken advantage of. And people are very public about what they don't want someone to tell them to do.
Right.
Pull over. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't do this.
Yeah.
Cops, they're so fucking ruthless. They'd pull you over for whatever. You know, I should be able to smoke my... You know. The reality is everybody who takes a sip of alcohol, smokes a joint, takes whatever pill they're going to take, they are literally being ordered to do something different than themselves. They're being taken advantage of. That's how I felt. I feel like I was in an abusive relationship with some twisted chick named Cinnamon, you know, or Tiffany. Sorry, Tiffany's out there. But like, that's what it starts to look like back there. When I look in the rear view and I say, God, and then, you know, it's like, fuck, man, you got situations that you put yourself in. Like you would never put your kid or your loved ones in the situations that, I mean, I'd gobble down 5 hits of ecstasy, a couple hits of acid. I mean, who fucking knows how many days we were up.
Right.
I mean, you are not you. You are a different human being operating on like a marionette, right? Like you're the puppet, like just, and yet we don't really look at it like that.
No.
We don't look at being taken advantage of. You're being marketed to by every fucking outfit in the world.
Yeah.
You know, oh, you got this. Like, oh, come celebrate at the San Ysidro Ranch and sip at this great wine and do this. Everything revolves, and I see it now. It's clear as a bell. Wherever you go, you're being told, maybe even ordered,
not to be yourself.
You know, subtly, to not be yourself, because yourself sucks.
Yes, it's one of the biggest lies that we all walk around telling ourselves.
Yeah,
is that we suck.
And I'm still coming to you. Yeah. There's no cure here, right? Like, I'm not like some, you know, almighty. I've still got my shit, right? I'm still unpacking a ton of stuff.
That is true, but you're also fundamentally more connected to yourself than ever, I think, in your entire life.
1,000%.
That's a miracle.
See, I'm not good at math.
You know, Josiah, when I see it and I get to go through it, then you become my hero because you have the courage to find yourself and to do everything you can to stay connected to yourself, despite the fact that sometimes it's incredibly painful, sometimes it's joyful, you know, confusing, whatever it might be. But the less, you know, like you say, less shit you put in your body, the easier it is to sort of find your own truth and feel connected to yourself. Now, I think that your tale is like incredibly inspiring, because if you go through all that shit and you can find a way at the age that you are, it's amazing. It's incredible.
It's never too late. I mean, honestly, everything's got to happen. It's like Justine and I couldn't have worked when we first met, right?
Yeah.
Me stopping drinking, you know, I think it's not even just drinking. It's any altering, anything that's taking you away from who you are. And I think it's a real shame. I mean, you know, I shared a pretty vulnerable story with you the other day, and you know, vulnerability is really fucking sexy, you know, and if we can work on being that way, and I'm really working hard at doing that. And, you know, you know, my dad always had this great line. It's like crawl, walk, run. You know, you can't do one without the other. You can't start a full sprint.
Yeah.
And you have to be patient with this stuff. And And babies who crawl, they need help from their moms and dads. Uh-huh. And then when you start walking, you still need help. And, you know, and you're in a full sprint, you need a trainer. You know, there's people are there, such as yourself, who've given me and my family so much joy and so much help. But it's just like, man, we're all really good people, you know?
Uh-huh. Yes,
and,
I do
know. And it's really sad. It's really sad to see people hide behind something that's just tearing them apart, tearing their families apart. I mean, I see it all the time. And it's like, God, like, it's so easy to go out. Oh, you want to go meet for a drink? I'm like, there was a funny line. We watched Good Will Hunting the other night. And the guy, I can't remember what the line was, but Matt Damon said something like, why do we have to go out for a drink? Why can't we go out for chocolates? And it's like, why can't we go out for chocolates? You know, why can't we, does it have to be this, you know?
Because it's sometimes the only way people can
I don't think they connection. Know any, but I don't think people know any different. I don't think I knew any different. Like, and I grew up in the wine world where it's like, it's food, right? Yeah. Like I'm dealing with Italians and French and, you know, Spaniards and like wine it might as well be with a fork and knife. And so, and I think that's, part of me feels very sad about that too. I love a great wine. Like I love how it smells. I love the art of how it's made. But man, can you do it without alcohol?
Yes.
Please.
Well, you know.
It tastes like shit.
Well, I love hearing what you're saying because I'm a really lucky person. I have no connection to alcohol because I have one drink and I'm like under the table asleep.
Yeah.
So my body's just cannot tolerate it. So it's been really easy for me not to fall into that trap. But because of what I do for a living, I hear endless tales of how alcohol's fucked up people's lives, relationships, everything. It's just astounding to me how romanticized we've made something that is that destructive.
It's so incredible.
Yeah.
Anyway. I mean, you told me something one day, I never really thought about it, but you told me that alcohol to me is a stimulant.
Yes.
And you're right. You know, one is just lubricant, two, it's gasoline, and three, four, five,
rocket fuel.
Let's go.
Yeah. So, Josiah, we're running a little bit short on time, but I want to make sure that you feel like you've had the opportunity to say everything that's important to you today. Is there anything else that you can think of that you want to add? You've been incredibly candid, and I love what you've had to say.
I want to thank you for all that you've done, and I want to, you know, thank everybody who's been brave enough to come on your show and talk about all their stuff. It's super inspiring. Anybody who's brave enough to go talk about their shit and confront themselves is doing a cool thing because people do listen. People do care.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how people reach you, but if I could ever be of assistance to somebody, if I can ever, you know, be that person that.
Well, you are being that person right here today.
I understand. But I mean, if somebody needs more than that, I'm a pretty easy guy to find. I just, you know, I know it's difficult. I trust. I mean, this shit's fucking hard. And I just want people to know. I know how hard it is. And I hope you, I wish you well. I wish you the best. Because man, this other side is so much better. The biggest buzz you've ever ridden.
Well, thank you so much for being on my podcast. And you're an incredible inspiration, Josiah. I have so much respect for you.
Thank you, Dana. I appreciate it.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.